You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, as we are here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, being Wednesday, we are here with my good friend, at least I think we're here with my good friend, Mr. Rod Bennett. You there, Rod? Okay, we are still trying to get Rod on the blower, but at any rate, when we get Rod, we will be talking. And he's here. Okay, good. I knew we would get him back. Technical difficulties. That's all right. At any rate, Rod is the author of such fine books as Four Witnesses, which is a great book on the Apostolic Fathers. He's the author of The Apostasy That Wasn't and Chesterton's America and The Christus Experiment. And good golly, he's just, an all-around swell guy and raconteur. We had him on Monday, too, with Sherry Antonetti because thought it'd be fun to just talk about the writing life. I actually got a nice email from somebody saying, you know, you're conversation on Monday has just inspired me to try again my hand at writing, and that was like everything I was shooting for.
How about that? So, well, that's excellent.
Yes, so
I'm
good.
Glad to hear that.
Good has been done by you, Rod Bennett, of East Tennessee, out there in the Smoky Mountains.
I'm in Georgia today, but.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, okay. I'm away from my home base today and out on the road a little bit. So been down in a kind of a surprise visit to see my I didn't see anybody. I just had to make a quick trip down to Atlanta today. So
okay. But, you were visiting the separating mass grave of the recent terror attack there.
I guess I hadn't heard about that one yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was right on the heels of Bowling Green, and
something about Atlanta, wasn't there?
Yes. It seems to have been some kind of dress rehearsal for the recent horror that unspooled in Sweden as well. So
I was just thinking about that earlier this week. You know, I would take these lectures about fake news a lot easier from this guy. If he wasn't the same guy that said Ted Cruz's dad killed JFK and what else? Obama's from Kenya and the CDC is hiding the facts about Ebola and all the rest of it. Sorry, I declined to be lectured about fake news from a guy who has never proved his own ability to tell the difference.
Well, you
the
know,
guy never met a conspiracy theory he didn't like.
Until
the Russian hacking of the election came along. That one is completely unbelievable, of course.
So, well, you know, you're criticizing a great man at your own risk, but
sorry about that. Chasing away listeners as we speak, I suppose.
Well, you know, speaking of conspiracy theories, there's a couple of things that came out in the news this week that just cracked me up. The first thing was, it was this article, it was in a science journal. Apparently, some scientist has done the thing that like every science fiction movie and practically every, you know, pathogen outbreak video game warns you against doing. So it was this big story in the news about this scientist who got the funding and unthawed viruses, I guess is the technical term for plural viruses, and bacteria that have been in deep freeze for 50,000 years. So they basically, these are just living things that have not interacted in any way with the rest of the ecosphere for 50,000 years. So we know nothing about these things. And so she thought it'd be a good idea to unthaw them. And it was like, you know, you read the story and it's like, yeah, we don't know anything about this stuff, but we'll just unthaw it and see what happens. And, and it's like, you know, so all I could think of was like, okay, look, if she mutates into some kind of hideous spider queen and her, you know, her lab assistants all become, you know, enslaved henchmen, and her ex-boyfriend, who's a Marine, has to, you know, storm the lab with his troops and, you know, make their way through unimaginable horrors to, you know, the heart of, you know, what had been her lab but is now her lair. You know, just...
Well, you got to admit, it might be a great movie. Maybe it's worth taking the chance for the movie rights, huh?
It's, well, yeah, you're right. There is something to be said for that, you know. But, yeah, you read those stories, you know, it's just like, okay, this seems inadvisable. I've seen a lot of movies and video games that say this is a bad idea, but they did it anyway. And so far, no one has begun to mutate. So I take that as a plus. And,
you know, it does tend to undermine your confidence in these people when they say, take our word for it. The Large Hadron Collider will not cause a black hole to happen.
Yes.
Think, well, okay, yes, but there was that lady that unthawed the viruses. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So far, none of those things seem to pan out, and that's good, you know.
I just did another tour. Speaking of mad scientists, I just did another tour of the my daughter goes to school in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And those who know a little American history know that the Oak Ridge National Laboratory is where the uranium and plutonium and stuff was made for the atomic bombs in World War II.
I did not know that.
They call it the secret city because overnight the U.S. government built a city of 40,000 people out in the middle of the cow pastures of East Tennessee and kept it completely quiet for years while they tried to separate uranium-235 from regular uranium. And so that's where it all happened, and it's a pretty fascinating story. You go there and make the tour today, and it's weird science, no doubt about it.
That's interesting. Hanford is down in South Central Washington State.
Yeah, that's your. In fact, the three sites associated with the Manhattan Project have all just within the past year been lumped together into a new national park, the Manhattan Project National Park. And three sites are Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Los Alamos, New Mexico, and Hanford, Washington.
Okay.
Oak Ridge is where the fuel was made, which was the biggest part of the project. So it's by far the most elaborate of the site.
Okay.
Los Alamos is just some shacks out in the desert where they actually made the device, the mechanical device that was the bomb, you know. Couldn't do anything without the fuel, but the bomb part of the bomb.
Yeah.
And then Hanford is where a lot of the dangerous separation experiments were done. Hanford, you could probably testify. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's in the bleak kind of remote parts of Washington.
Yeah,
they figured it was safe out there.
They put it right. It's right on the Columbia River, and they buried a lot of radioactive stuff out there in the desert, and you know there has been. you know, there's been historically for the last few decades is a higher cancer rate and all the rest of it. I got to go to Los Alamos a couple of years ago.
Did you?
It was a really interesting place. It's the most.
I bet it was.
It's a very strangely morally conflicted place.
Oh, yeah.
It has kind of, you drive into town, and there's a big sign as you drive into town. It says, "Welcome to Los Alamos, where discoveries are made." And it's like, what was discovered here?
Like the sign in the air over the Air Force Base in Dr. Strangelove, "Peace is our profession."
"Peace is our profession." Well, yeah, well,
which was a real slogan, by the way.
It's true. We're coming up on a break here, but when we get back, I'll tell you a little bit about the history of Los Alamos because it's really fascinating. There's like these sort of archaeological layers of the history of this town that are kind of a weird psychological profile of everything that happened to the United States in the 20th century. So when we get back, we'll talk about Los Alamos, New Mexico. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett, and we will be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett, and we're talking a little bit about mad scientists and atomic warfare and fun things, you know. But I got a chance a couple of years ago. The very nice people at I think the parish there is called St. Kateri Tekakwitha Parish, if memory serves. I could be wrong, but that's what I think it is, in Los Alamos. And so they had me down to speak. That's where I met Devin Rose, in fact.
How about that?
He lived in the area at the time, and so he came out to visit.
So you got called to speak at a Catholic parish in Los Alamos.
In Los Alamos, Mexico.
We're talking about the Manhattan Project today, and you just happen to have been there and have all kinds of interesting information, huh?
Yeah, well, I got to go there twice, so I went there.
What a small world this is. I was in Oak Ridge, and you've been to Los Alamos. So.
That's right. That's right.
We got all the bases covered on this program, folks.
It's true. And Hanford. I've been to Hanford, too. So I figure my chances of acquiring cancer are very high now. So that's good. In fact, I've already had cancer a couple of times. But now I'm a cancer survivor, which gives me tons of sympathy points from people. It's how you shut down a discussion. People start getting uppity and just say, "I'm a cancer survivor." And then everybody feels strangely guilty for some reason, like for some reason it's their fault somehow. But so I went down there and spoke, and they liked me, and so they asked me to come back. And they said, we're going to have your whole family down. Really? Okay, thanks. And so they did. They paid our way. So I brought Jan and Pete and Sean. This is a couple of years ago. And so we go there. We rented a car in Albuquerque, and we drove up to Los Alamos. So you go through Santa Fe, and then you take this road.
The left turn in Albuquerque?
Into town. Yes, took a left turn in Albuquerque. And
probably a lot of our audience is too young to get that. But Bugs Bunny was always taking the famous left turn at Albuquerque.
I knew I should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque.
But
so anyway, go to Los Alamos, and you drive up into the hills. And what was fascinating was going to the local museums. Because the history of the town was this. So, like, right at the turn of the last century, the scion of a wealthy family back east was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And so they didn't have antibiotics. So what you did was you sent people out to take the cure in the pure, clean, fresh desert air of New Mexico, in this case. So they sent this guy. His name was Ashley Pond. And there's actually a pond in the middle of the town now called, creatively, Ashley Pond. And so
I thought
Ashley
you were going to say it was the Pond.
Yes.
Which I suppose it is in short, right?
It could be. He came out there and he just fell in love with the place. It was just this beautiful, high desert a place up in the mountains. The air was just as pure as anything. And this is right in the early first decade of the 20th century. And so while he's out there taking the cure, he gets wind of this brand new thing that has just been invented by a British guy named Baden-Powell called the Boy Scouts. And he thinks that the Boy Scouts is just a fantastic idea. And so he decides what this place would be great for would be to found an all-boys school and have it, you know, be built on the principles of the Boy Scouts and all the rest of it. And so that's what he does. This guy, he's loaded with money. And so he just builds this school. And it's this devoted to just to raising young men of civic virtue. And so they learn their Hebrew, Latin, and Greek, and they go out and they do their exercises, and they all have their Boy Scout uniforms. And it was apparently just this boys' paradise in the early part of the 20th century. And so they build up this school, and it's this beautiful, wonderful, idyllic place. Well, sometime in the 20s, a guy goes out on a hike in New Mexico and hikes up into Los Alamos and never forgot this place. He really thought this was an amazing place. That hiker's name was Robert Oppenheimer.
right, yeah.
And so Oppenheimer remembers this place. So
he said, that'd be a good place for us to nuke until it glows.
Well, it was just in the back of his mind. So in September 1933, a Hungarian physicist steps off a curb in London, England, and as he's stepping off the curb, a thought occurs to him. You can yield an enormous amount of energy if you split a large unstable uranium atom. That physicist's name was Leo Szilard.
Right.
And this starts to bother him, and throughout the 30s, it begins to bother him more and more and more that it's possible to do this, and that the Germans have a lot of really good physicists.
Right.
And so he finally goes to, he tries to alert the world, but
two of those German physicists won the Nobel Prize for actually doing it in 1938.
Yes.
And that was the key. That was where our Hungarian scientist got with his friends, some German scientists, and said, you know, this is a problem.
Right. And so he tries to alert people, but nobody cares because he's Leo Szilard and nobody knows who he is or cares who he is. So finally he goes to his friend Albert Einstein, because everybody knows
who had achieved, some notoriety by this point.
Right. And so he says, look, Einstein, you get the problem, right? Einstein says, yes, I get the problem. He says, okay, here's what needs to happen. I will write a letter, if you'll sign it, and send it to Roosevelt and say, it's all hands on deck. You need to get going with this right away because the Germans are working on a bomb. And so that's what Einstein does. So Einstein writes a famous letter to FDR.
Well, he does agonize over it.
Right.
It was not a slam dunk for Einstein.
No.
In other words, he says, obviously, if somebody's got to get this thing, it would be better for Franklin Roosevelt to have it than for Adolf Hitler to have it.
Right, exactly.
But maybe there's some way to keep anybody from having it. And he finally decided that there really wasn't.
Right. Well, and we tried, and we actually succeeded because partly through some serendipity, the Germans initially, in order to control atomic reactions, they initially looked at graphite, which Germany just has tons of graphite. But due to a mistake in their calculations, they conclude that graphite won't be good as a control substance, and so they begin looking at heavy water. Well, heavy water was like super complicated to produce and required a huge industrial base, which was easy to bomb. And we did a lot of that. We were constantly bombing their heavy water factories. And so consequently, through serendipity and a concerted bombing campaign, we slowed down the German effort to build a bomb. Meanwhile,
now just let me complicate that just a little bit more too, if you don't mind.
Okay.
You got a much better memory than I do. I was just in Oak Ridge a week ago, and I don't remember it as well as you do. But one aspect of the story that's worth bringing out is that the Germans felt that. They saw how to do it. They saw that separating the fuel would be the difficult part. And
right.
They estimated that it would take 10 years probably to have enough fuel to make one bomb, mm-hmm. which wasn't too far off the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that information, they got some figures that showed, that it was out of reach. And maybe rocketry was the better secret weapon to go for.
Yeah.
So Hitler apparently himself chose to put his brilliant German scientists to work on rockets rather than atomic weapons. It may very well be that our friend Dr. Werner Heisenberg, who is famous for his uncertainty principle, everybody's heard of Heisenberg, thanks to Breaking Bad. Dr. Heisenberg continued to work in Germany after Einstein left.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some reason to think that he may have doctored the numbers because he didn't want Hitler to get an atomic weapon. He was still in Germany. He was still ostensibly working for the German government, but he didn't trust Hitler with an atomic weapon. So there's a pretty good argument to be made that he deliberately sabotaged the German A-bomb net.
Thanks be to God. We are up against the break, but when we return, we will continue hearing the story of Los Alamos and mad scientists and the atomic bomb and all kinds of other stuff. We'll be back with Rod Bennett right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. If you want to join the conversation, by the way, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And So all this is going on. The U.S. is starting to realize Hitler's working on a bomb, and they got to get off the dime and do something. And so Roosevelt taps a military guy and a civilian physicist guy. I forget the military guy's name, but he was one of these guys, you know.
General Leslie Groves.
That's it.
His name. That's
kind of your classic can-do, cigar-chomping, you know, get it done. Yeah.
In fact, yeah, he was not at all convinced that he was frustrated that he wasn't going to the front. He was sent to the backwoods of Tennessee to build a city and start a gigantic laboratory. And he wasn't at all convinced that anything would come out of it. He was very skeptical about the whole project.
Well, and then they get this other guy who was this, you know, as far from a military type as he could possibly be, Robert Oppenheimer.
Right.
And Oppenheimer is, if anybody out there has ever seen a series that ran in the mid-aughts, which was loads of fun, by the way, called Eureka. Eureka is this fun science fiction series about this town in Oregon called Eureka. That's basically, it's a secret government program where everybody in the town is like this, you know, 5,000 IQ science geek type, right? And that's all they do is they just work on their bizarre science experiments. And then you've got the sheriff who's just, he's the stand-in for us, right? We're all dumb. And he's the dumb sheriff who's always trying to figure out what's going on. And every week there's some bizarre problem that happens because somebody invented time travel or, you know, created, you know, an interdimensional portal or, you know, all these kinds of weird things going on all the time. But anyway, it was Oppenheimer's job to basically found Proto-Eureka. And so they needed a place. The fear at the outbreak of the war was that the Japanese were not going to stop, that the West Coast was ground zero for invasion, and that we were going to wind up with Japanese-occupied Western states. And so what they did was they looked around for some place to put the most secret facility on planet Earth, devoted entirely to building an atomic bomb, which no one had ever done. And so at this point, Oppenheimer goes, I remember this nice little town from this hike that I took back in the 20s. Called Los Alamos. And so he picks Los Alamos as his site for this is going to be the town that's going to be absolutely completely devoted to doing one thing, inventing an atomic bomb to incinerate Japanese cities. And, or in this case, German cities, because they're still, at this point, they're still thinking about Germany and winning this race with Germany. So Oppenheimer goes to this town that was like this boy's paradise for the last three decades. It was just this wonderful place where this boy's school was and all this wonderful golden childhood memories for, you know, countless boys. And the feds walk into Los Alamos, New Mexico one day in early 1942, remember Pearl Harbor is December 1941, they walk into Los Alamos in early 1942 and they say, this is a really beautiful town, you guys. Get out. And that's it. That's the end of the boys' school, the end of that entire period in Los Alamos history. Everybody gets kicked out except for a few Spanish-speaking workers who they make sure are Spanish-speaking and can't understand what's being discussed. They're allowed to stay so they can do things like groundskeeping and stuff. And everybody else is kicked out. And then they move in, this huge population of young, the average age of the town was 25 years old. And they bring in these super genius scientists and their wives who are also super geniuses. And then those guys just had a wonderful time for 3 years just doing cutting edge physics. And when they weren't doing that, they would have these lovely parties. I've actually walked past Oppenheimer's house. Yeah, it's this nice house, you know, and everybody would meet at Oppie's house and they would have these parties and stuff. And then during the rest of the week, they were busy inventing an atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So they built their first gadget and then they took it down in July 1945. They took it down to Alamogordo, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Trinity test site, and they were sure it was going to work, and it did. And so the bomb went off. Oppenheimer famously, you know, as he watched it through his heavy, dark tinted glasses, he remembered a line from the Bhagavad Gita: "I am become death, the shatterer of worlds." And he watched it go off, and a couple of weeks later, they had loaded Fat Man and Little Boy onto planes for the South Pacific, right, and they were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And almost immediately, of course, you have this intensely morally conflicted community now that knows that all this hard work and wonderful time and together that we had, and all the, you know, the lovely dinner parties and the camaraderie and the joie de vivre. And what was it for? It was so that we could murder 30,000 civilians in their beds.
Yep.
And
well, I hate to say it, but the United States and many other countries had gotten used to the idea of murdering civilians in their beds by this point, since most of the combatants had been doing it all through the war. Using conventional weapons, yes. A mm-hmm. bit less dramatic than doing it all in one stroke, but it was often done all in one night with firebombs and other horrible inventions.
We actually killed more people at Dresden than we did with the nukes.
Right. But the reason I finesse the point there is that I think sometimes in arguments over the morality of atomic weapons, the point is lost because people treat it as a... they get hung up on the fact that it was done in a dramatic new way with a super weapon. In reality, the moral watershed was crossed when people began, when the Allies began targeting civilian populations.
Yes, it was.
The evil of the atomic weapon was, I won't say that it was free of evil in any way, but I will say that the evil of those particular acts was they were aimed at purely civilian populations. Neither Hiroshima or Nagasaki had any military value at all. It was purely a psychological weapon.
Right.
But of course, that had been, both sides had been doing that since early on in the war.
Right. I mean,
and,
you know,
that's
Germans
where
started
Catholic
with the
moral
blitz.
Theology steps in. You can never target civilians.
Right.
We understand that sometimes civilians get killed in war, but that can never be the purpose.
Right.
And then of course, people want to come step in and say, well, you know, in modern total war, is there really such a thing as a civilian? And that path leads to the dark side, I'm afraid.
Yes, yeah.
And,
well, you know.
And it definitely did in this case. So there's a bit of a sequel to the story you've just told us. I just read a most fascinating book about Operation Paperclip. Have you ever heard of the term Operation Paperclip before?
No.
Operation Paperclip was the American effort to bring German scientists after World War II, to bring all the brilliant brains that gave us the V-2 and all sorts of other things to the United States so that they could go to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And... We, you know, there's the famous quip in Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, that the reason we got to the moon ahead of the Russians was because our Germans were better than their Germans. But there's definitely some truth in it, because both sides, after the war ended, cleaned out Berlin of all of its brain trust and took as many as they could to the east or to the west, depending upon their politics and the politics of the conquerors, not the politics of the conquered, which in many cases were pure unreconstructed Nazism. And the interesting point about all of this is that we started out trying to discriminate. We said, look, you're talking about bringing Nazi scientists, people with war crimes records, the kind of people were hanging at Nuremberg. You're talking about bringing thousands of them, literally thousands of them, settling them in the United States in little suburban homes and having them work in American universities and military bases.
That was exactly the number, idea.
The number of these men were actually SS officers who had taken a personal blood oath of loyalty to Adolf Hitler.
We're up against the break, Rod, but Rod, we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back with Rod Bennett right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to the technology challenge. Connecting the dots. Where any minute now, we will get rid of that dial tone. And then soon we will have Rod Bennett back on the air. Los Alamos was a fascinating place for me. Because it was kept so secret, of course, you had young married couples. As I say, the average age in Los Alamos during World War II was 25 years old. No one in the entire town was unemployed because they were all part of the most secret organization on planet Earth. It was so secret that a young senator, Harry S. Truman of Missouri, started noticing that a lot of money was going somewhere that couldn't be tracked down. And when he set out as
I'm back now.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Just talking about the weirdness of the Manhattan Project was that it was so secret that if you were born there during those years, your official birthplace is listed as P.O. Box such and such, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Because
Oak Ridge was the fifth largest city in Tennessee at the end of the war, and it appeared on no maps.
Right. It was exactly the same thing in Los Alamos. They were just completely off the grid. And when Harry Truman tried to figure out where tons of money was going, because it was just going into this vortex and vanishing and nobody knew where it was going. And so he set out being the young crusading senator. He was going to figure out what, this fraud and waste in the military and so forth. And FDR took him aside and said, drop it. And he was like, oh, okay, so all of this came out as the war ended.
The interesting thing about all of the city and about talking about this program to bring Nazi scientists to America is that we started out trying to weed out not being own people connected with war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Nazi partisans. It originally was pretty idealistic. And they realized, well, most of these people had been Nazi party members. Well, okay. Okay. And then gradually we started bringing them all in. And the reason for it is that we were afraid the Russians would get them first. In other words, if we didn't take these people out of Germany, the Soviets would. And so that mentality of the arms race is included in the whole idea of building these things. But we took people who had done experiments on living people in camps, you know, deliberately froze people to death to see if you could bring them back to life again. Right. You know, all just horrible stuff. And the very same people went to work in our own space medicine labs and other things like that. And it happened because we said, you know, if we don't do this, yes, it's horrible, but if we don't do this first, the other guys will.
Yeah.
So that's the whole mentality that took over. And pretty soon you've got literal Nazi scientists doing the same crap that they were doing for Hitler, doing it for us. The man who invented sarin gas for Hitler was brought to America and started making sarin gas for us.
Yeah.
And we had thousands of tons of it by 1950 or so.
Yeah.
And we developed a biological warfare program. And all of this stuff was literally being done by Nazi scientists.
Yep.
And you think, but why did we fight the war if, I mean, wasn't this the reason we didn't want Hitler in charge? Because he did crap like this?
Right.
Well, now we're doing the same stuff.
Yeah.
So the whole thing as a case study in consequentialism is pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Let us do evil that good may come of it.
Yeah, that good may come of it. Yeah, you know, and in a lot of ways, I mean, you can trace the pedigree of this in the United States back to William Tecumseh Sherman. You know, well, I mean, Sherman basically said, yeah, we need to make war on civilians.
Total war. The whole idea of total war. You're right. He did accept the idea that we just prolong the war and make it worse for everybody by discriminating, by being so gentle.
Yep.
Well, the problem with that is that assumes that you're going to win the war. You know, you're saying, well, it only prolongs the war. Well, that's exactly what the Confederates were trying to do, was prolong the war.
Yeah.
So you're begging the question, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff is a slippery slope towards really terrible, terrible evil.
Yeah.
The Russians were bringing the most horrible people they could find to Russia because they were afraid we would get them first. Because unlike us, They didn't share this belief that Americans would never do anything horrible like that.
Yeah. Well,
you know, Americans are human beings, and the Bible tells us they're all fallen, and they all are prone to do horrible stuff.
Yeah.
And
I will say this.
If you want a happy ending to take out of this story, you can say something nice about Richard Nixon here.
Okay.
Richard Nixon, you found out that we had spent $26 billion or something on sarin gas bombs, and that we had enormous warehouses full of these gas bombs that were so deadly that they had to be additional millions were spent on keeping the bombs safe where they sat in the warehouse to keep them from leaking.
Mm-hmm.
And we were still doing this in the 1970s. And Richard Nixon said, look, this is horrible stuff. It's a waste of money. Let's spend however much we have to spend to get rid of the sarin gas. And the executive orders have gotten a bad rap lately, but by executive order, Richard Milhouse Nixon ordered that we'd get out of the nerve gas business, and we did.
Thanks be to God. And there were spills. There were accidents. There was a spill in Wyoming back in the 60s, which was covered up. But it killed, you know, a ton of livestock out in the middle of Wyoming when there was a train derailment. And fortunately, it was out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. when this happened. But if it had happened in a major urban area, it would have killed thousands of people.
But it's almost as if weapons of mass destruction in and of themselves are morally evil.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might almost say this is God's way of, you know, if getting involved in this stuff, however good intentions or however innocently, leads you to literally put people who did experiments on live Jews in Germany, to put these people in charge of your space medicine program in the United States, then that's God's way of saying, you know, this is, you missed a step somewhere, guys.
Yeah. 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 That's, it's a bizarre ongoing problem. In human history, but, the temptation to power, and our desire to use these weapons, because that's part of the problem with a weapon like this. You know, one of the things that you often hear, you hear this in the gun control debate a lot, but a weapon is just a tool. It's morally neutral. And that sounds reasonable, but the thing is that technology affects us.
Yeah.
So,
I said, the next thing you know, you've got all of Hitler's people working for you. And there's a message in there that you have crossed a barrier somewhere, you've crossed a line, and it needs to send up red flags. But what usually happens is people congratulate themselves for being tough. See, we'd all be speaking Russian if these brave men hadn't made all this poison gas and stuff and made all these compromises for the sake of our peace and liberty. We'd all be speaking Russian now.
And brave men,
but that's
hands.
Just what the Nazis did, you know?
Yeah. And in fact,
WANSI conference, that was exactly what Dr. Goebbels told the men assembled there. You guys will be honored one day for the brave sacrifices that you've done. You've saved the world by being tough and not being wussy about all of these dirty jobs we've had for you.
There's a speech that Himmler gives in October of 1943 to the SS, who have been busy murdering millions of people in Eastern Europe. And it's really remarkable to listen to the speech, because one of the things that I've long maintained is that when people commit grave evil, what they almost always do is they describe it using the language of courage. And that's exactly what Himmler does. Well, we're up against the break again.
It was a dirty job, but somebody had to do it.
Oh,
and you guys shouldered the Herculean task.
We are at the end of the hour, I am sad to say, but I want to thank you, Rod Bennett, for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Danny Head. And I will be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.